Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Cambridge Inside Out. I'm Robert Winters, and once again, I'm going to be doing this solo. I thought maybe what I would do this time around here is just sort of kick off with just a little bit of a project that I'm started working on just a day or so ago. That I don't know, maybe it's of interest to some folks, maybe not. It's really quite honestly, it's sort of based on the fact that we are kind of living, I wouldn't call it necessarily a news desert, but, you know, the paper of record for ever since the founding of City of Cambridge in 1846 is the Cambridge Chronicle, and it's kind of been lacking, shall we say. It has no regular editor, not since Will Dowd left, and so we're kind of reliant on others. You know, I do my part in some ways, the folks over at Cambridge Day do their part. But there are various other entities that are in one way or another helping to contribute to local news. So what I thought I might also say, as I sort of jump over to this screen here, that, you know, sometimes those of us who follow civic affairs in Cambridge, we forget that we actually have Somerville, Belmont, Watertown, Boston. You know, just for those who haven't heard of that little town, just to the south of us, and Boston consists of many, many neighborhoods. And so what I thought I would do, just to, somewhat on a lark, but I think really with some sense of purpose, was to just start gathering, it'll take a little time to do it, all the various news sources that are actually available in and around Cambridge. Today, I actually had a few suggestions from some other people, so I invited people to just click and let me know if they had some additions. So I added some. You know, I'm actually reminded Adam Gaffin, who is responsible for Universal Hub. Once upon a time, many years ago, actually, come to think of it, for those of us who had been doing some kind of interaction via online, but had never met each other in person, we actually organized a little get together for various people who were maintaining what you might call civic blogs or web blogs, as they were once then called, and people who had been contributing but never actually met each other in person. So we met down at Doyle's in Jamaica Plain over some beer and pizza, which was really great, actually. Kind of wish we'd do it again, you know, just get some of the people who were doing similar, you know, efforts in their own little ways to just get together, compare notes, do things like that. So anyway, what I did was I, you know, just somewhat randomly just started grabbing various sources that I was aware of and some that I was not aware of. You know, there are actually some groupings like called the Advocate for covering Malden, Everett, Revere, and Saugus. The Gannett Corporation, which owns the Cambridge Chronicle, they have a lot of papers that they have in various communities. I'll grow this list eventually, but I just happened to grab the Newton Tab, Cambridge Chronicle, and Waltham News Tribune, but there are certainly plenty more to be added there. One of the ones I thought I would do for those who've never really clued into Universal Hub, which I think has been a great resource for quite a few years, in addition to the main Boston, you know, the hub, of course, refers to Boston, they put together individual pages for all many, many, many communities. And as somebody pointed out to me, but I guess I had already known about it, but I just had hesitated to include it, there's an entity which is funded from, I actually forget who the ownership of patch.com is, but, you know, I think there is a certain amount of money is paid for people to help orchestrate some of these things for many, many, many communities. Really, I think it's all around the country, but certainly in Massachusetts, these are all online resources. So anyway, if there are any additions that you know of that you want to sort of toss in here, you know, I included some of the local university papers, including the Crimson, which occasionally is factual, and occasionally useful. But if you've got any suggestions, you can sort of help add to this. I'm not quite sure ultimately what the finished product is going to be, you know, whether it's going to be, you know, just one page of local news, because I kind of have that going, or whether I'll group it by communities or by there are these natural groupings like those which are owned, part of the chain, the Gannett Corporation, as well as the Patch, et cetera. So anyway, maybe I'll do multiple ways of listing it here, but I thought, for those of us who occasionally live in our little Cambridge silo, it's not a bad idea to kind of look all around us. And even for those who just want to look locally, just to be aware that there are a few sources and maybe there should be more. And by the way, one other thing I've noticed, and I think I hope I'm not being pointlessly optimistic in this, is that, even the Cambridge Chronicle, which it basically hadn't run a story on Cambridge in ages, just pathetic, quite honestly. Just recently, they actually had some things with some, awards, for Fresh Pond and whatever, and a few other things for some of the people who are the organizers of the Cambridge Jazz Festival. So at least there's something having to do with Cambridge starting to slowly appear in the Chronicle. I'm of the point of view that eventually the ownership will realize that there is an asset that's worth cultivating there, and they'll revitalize it a little bit, maybe even hire an editor one of these days. And maybe if they're smart, what they'll do is they'll learn to work cooperatively with various other partners locally, who are sort of in the same business, and so we can all just sort of help make something really, really worthwhile. So anyway, we'll see how it goes. So anyway, I thought I would at least mention that because I think it's something of value. Another thing I'll thought I'd mention is I went to, well, I mean, it was a sort of a crossing of several things. I think every year on Valentine's Day, I'm always reminded of the fact that I arrived here on Valentine's Day and on the, as I recently wrote, on the shores of Cambridge, washed up on the shores of Cambridge, after the blizzard of 1978. So it's actually been 46 years, which frightens me when I even think about that. But the truth of the matter is that I was planning to come up here. I had applied to go to graduate school, had not yet been accepted, but I was going to live here anyway. And I couldn't get here because the blizzard of 78 had closed down the interstates. And the first day that I was able to get out of New York and come up to Boston was on Valentine's Day. So it's very easy to remember, Blizzard of 78, Valentine's Day, that's when I got here, right? So anyway, so I always think back about how, there's this, I once wrote a piece, over 25 years ago now, I think, called, just noting the fact that I had been living in Cambridge for 20 years, and yet I will never be a native, right? So which led to some wonderful responses, including one absolutely marvelous piece by Glenn Kutcher called How to Become a True Cantabrigian, which anyway, these are the things I think about at this time of year. So it's not, you'll never be a native as such, but you can basically hang with the bros, and you can be, if you can find Patty's lunch and have a beer, you're getting started at least, so anyway, that happened to coincide with my going to a meeting a Cambridge City Council. It was a kind of a not, I think, purposefully not well advertised meeting where the councilors were going to get together to talk about their revising their goals and objectives, which is something they say they want to do regularly, but they never seem to get around to doing it regularly. I think the last update was adopted in October of 2017, which is now, over well over 6 years ago. So much for annual updates to your goals and objectives, right? But and by the way, the existing goals and objectives, which I've sort of keep on my website so people can find it, because usually you can find things a little easier on my site than you can on the city site. I guess the guiding principle, I guess a good word somebody introduced me to some months ago was the word anodyne. It's sort of pretty commonplace, doesn't really say a whole lot, Like if you say that what we believe in is we want to be accessible, deliberate, diverse, efficient, equitable, innovative, navigable, neighborly, resilient, and rooted. I guess we could all say that, right? So it doesn't really distinguish the Cambridge City Council from any sort of well-meaning person or organization, quite honestly. There's also a list of 12 goals, not surprisingly, and it's not, I don't think it's necessarily in priority order, but it might be. Goal number one was increase access to affordable housing for all income groups, and so on and so on and so on. I won't go through it all. But so they gathered together. Originally it was supposed to be over at the Foundry, and then the last minute, I think because there was a threat of 12 inches of snow, which none of which ever arrived. But they moved to City Hall Annex, which just happens to be, I mean, I could roll out of bed and be there in about a minute. It's that close to me. So I went to the meeting. And it's sort of interesting because no public comment or anything like that, but it's sometimes good to witness this stuff just to see what people are thinking. I don't believe it was televised. Pretty sure it wasn't televised, but it might have been. I'm not really sure. Anyway, it's interesting because so you get, I think there were eight city councilors present. One of them, Councillor Wilson, was checking in via Zoom. And it's a gathering where they can kind of let the hair down, so to speak, with the city staff, some of the major city staff, city manager, deputy city manager, and a few other sort of major figures. Certainly people from the city clerk's office were monitoring the Zoom part of things. Anyway, I always find it interesting. It's kind of one of those exercises that only a civic nerd could love, but. But there are the usual civic nerds like me, John Hawkinson, and one rather forgettable other third player there as well. But anyway, it was interesting, and I found myself sort of jotting down some notes, and it kind of led to my writing a bit of an essay on Valentine's Day that I just called "Random Thoughts." But it was largely spurred just by notions and things that I saw rooted in that meeting. One of the things that I found noteworthy, only because it's something I've experienced myself over the years, is sometimes rather than getting together, nine city councilors, some city staff, and just shooting the breeze, and figuring out what they have in common and what their principal goals are, they bring in a facilitator or a facilitation company in this case, which involved two people. And I'm, you know, I've When I've worked in various programs, like when I worked for the Office of Minority Education at MIT and various other things, we would have some of these sort of facilitated meetings. I hate them. I mean, I really hate them, where there's, in some respects, the facilitating company, maybe they're helpful in some ways, but in a way, they're sort of in the business of keeping contracts coming. And so there's a sort of a way you do facilitation that I think tries to make you be as essential as possible, whether they really need you or not. But it is kind of interesting watching these sort of leading questions from facilitators, and then it's kind of like a soft, perverse competition among city councilors to try and step over each other to seem especially relevant or sensitive or something at these things, like it was some kind of weird encounter group. And I think these kinds of facilitated meetings they have some things in common with these various trainings that they often put you through these days. And I honestly, I would really rather visit a dentist than go to some of these things, quite honestly. But there's some interesting things that you can learn. You can certainly get a see a different side of your elected officials than maybe you see when they're sort of doing their usual performance at city council meetings. One of the things that I think it was somebody, I think it was one of the city councilors noted was something that, I wish more of the councilors would understand, which is that there's a big difference between sort of the performative aspect of a city council meeting, which, by the way, didn't used to be so performative. It used to be more of a business meeting back before there were cameras and Zoom and all of those things, where now it's sort of like you're trading off your speech making. You know, I think the only one who used to really make speeches years ago was Al Vellucci, and those were just because that was just the way Al Vellucci was, you know. But now they, you know, it seems like they, you know, you get your time, you make your speech, and do all of that. But whether that's ha you're actually getting anything accomplished at a city council meeting or not is really, I think that's debatable. But the city council subcommittee meetings, or we just call them committee meetings, would often be a place where actual work would take place. It tended to be a little bit more informal. And at least in the better days, these committee meetings, if you were a member of the public who had something worthwhile to say, you'd often be invited in to speak freely. And it wasn't just sort of like it is now during public comment at various meetings, where basically they shove it all either at the beginning or at the end of a meeting. You're given a fixed two, let's say typically 2 minutes these days, to make a little short speech and then shut up and sit down. But it's committee meetings, it used to be a little bit more informal. And, you know, if unless you were just howling at the moon, if you said something intelligent, it would actually be a back and forth with the elected officials, and you sort of would, you know, maybe kind of help shape things a little bit and be constructive. So I always like to do those sorts of exercises. They were pretty good. Nowadays, as I say, it's a little bit different right now. You know, where public comment and public input is, I mean, again, some can argue with this, but I do find it to be largely performative. It's not, you're not really part of anybody's conversation. You're just, you know, you're making a speech, or you're there with a group of people who are, you know, howling about something or other, and not necessarily getting good stuff done. But anyway, that was interesting. The another thing that was suggested, which I found interesting because it brought back a lot of memories, is one of the counselors suggested that Cambridge should adopt something like, I think Somerville uses, called the 311 system, which is basically a single point of contact where you can, you know, you dial 311, and then I think it's sort of like 911 for emergencies. There's another similar kind of line for, you know, if somebody's in some sort of distress. And I think this is more for like when you need to get something fixed. And I got me to thinking. I said, you know, it seems like we're in this constant state of reinventing the wheel, you know. So once upon a time, it actually worked pretty well, quite honestly. If there was a problem, you called Public Works, and they were incredibly responsive, and cordial, friendly, and available 24 hours a day, you know. So even, you know, whether it's something as simple as a missed trash pickup, or, you know, a pothole, or there being a car crash and, you know, there was debris all over the road, you know, you could reach them, and they were very responsive. Maybe that kind of became less so over time. I wouldn't necessarily say that about Public Works. I think they tended to be pretty good and remain pretty good, a very service-oriented department. But, you know, they started, and it used to be the case that if you didn't want to do that, if you happen to know a city councilor, you talked to us, you called up a city councilor, and then a city councilor would file an order asking the city management or city departments to look into a particular problem. We've kind of moved away from that. You know, they established a system where councilors could just enter these things as sort of almost like work orders. And then I think that's kind of interrelated with the so-called C-click fix system that we have now, where whether you're complaining about you know, graffiti complaints, potholes, blocked bike lanes, you know, there's they have a growing list of gripe categories, and you know, you chime in that away. But some, and I find them to be somewhat responsive, maybe because some of them know me, maybe they want to be extra helpful, I don't know. But apparently some people feel that the C-click fix system is now less than responsive, and it takes either forever to get a response. And I think it probably varies from department to department. So they were suggesting, well, maybe we should move to this 311 system. And I thought, all this constant revision, I don't know that it necessarily really makes things better. Why don't you just sort of just maintain what you got, and maybe you'll do a little bit better than that. I think there was one city councilor. It was actually Ed Sear. Years ago, we were walking back from something. He actually said to me something was pretty profound. He said, "The number of phone calls that we get asking us to do something is an interesting measure of dysfunction in the city." So, in other words, if everything's really, really functioning properly in the city, city councilors probably wouldn't get that many calls because everything's working fine. It's kind of like when there are, I think many people have pointed out that complaints tend to outnumber compliments, because if you're happy, you just go, "All right, I'm happy. See ya." You don't feel the need to, send in a message saying thank you. But if you're, pissed off about something, then you want to show up and, howl about it. It's kind of interesting. But one other thing it kind of triggered was a memory of some years ago. It was actually something that was forwarded by, I think it was Councillor J when Jim Browdy was on the city council for one term, from 2000 to 2001, where he and maybe a couple of other councillors proposed establishing what they called an ombudsman's office. So, in other words, the idea being that rather than contact city councillors when you've got a problem, or you need some information, you call the ombudsman's office. And it sounded like a good idea. Some people did that, but after a very short while, city councilors said, "Wait a minute, this is not a good idea at all," because part of the stock and trade of being a city councilor, especially if you're a constituent services oriented city councilor, was you want to be known as the guy who helped out the citizen. So to whatever degree you bypass the councilor and just go directly to an ombudsman who then fixes the problem, then there's no city councilor to take credit. There's no city councilor who you feel obliged to give them a number one vote in the next election. So rather quickly, the idea of an ombudsman office just disappeared. I think it got no support because people said this is not in our political best interest. It always reminds me of a interesting phrase that my friend David Good once said in talking about some of the rent control battles in Cambridge. He said that the reason why they would, until question nine, settled it with a state ballot question. The truth is that many city councilors didn't want to fix rent control and make it work better, because to whatever degree there was a danger of it being taken away, then you left people on edge, and so you wanted to vote for your pro-rent control city councilor to help keep it going or strengthen it. Or if you're dead set against rent control, you would want to call up Billy Walsh or someone else in order to rail on them, and then they would be your advocate. If you actually solved some of these problems, then there would be no need to be, leaning on the councilors and or voting for them, for that matter. So what David said was a great phrase. It was like they both sides benefit from the existence of a problem, And I often think about that when people are sort of coming up with various proposals for how to orchestrate solutions. Another topic that came up at this goals and objectives meeting that I always find, and it comes up in a variety of ways, is the way in which the open meeting law, which is in principle a good thing, actually sometimes has a perverse way of making things much more difficult and less efficient and effective. Just the obvious point being, if more than four city councilors are in principle not supposed to talk about anything of substance together outside of an open meeting, it kind of works against the idea of collaboration. And now, granted, you can get three or four councilors who can maybe get some stuff done, but sometimes you get, if there's some incident that happens in the city, you might have two or three councillors working on something, and then independently two or three other councillors working on something similar. And then they sort of show up at a meeting with competing orders rather than just having worked it out, because they're not permitted to work it out, which I find that to be kind of perverse. Sometimes I lump this together with Massachusetts General Laws, Chapter 30B, about municipal procurement. which is that it was done to make sure you weren't just giving contracts to your buddies and friends and relatives. You have to have proper competitive bidding procedures and whatever. But sometimes this actually gets in the way of just getting the job done. I say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't do that. It's going to take 6 weeks. We've got to put it out to bid. We've got to do this and that. So the city, in some ways, through what they call house doctors and other mechanisms, they kind of find ways to work within that system. But it's a good intention to have some sort of uniform procurement so that people are not being corrupt. But sometimes it can actually make things A, more expensive. Yeah, and same, by the way, same thing also true with various other ordinances that were well-intentioned in terms of having a certain percentage of either women or minority, or you have, if you wanted to require unions to be involved and whatever, you can end up having everything cost considerably more that way, which is kind of the downside of a good idea, to be sure. Again, I won't go on and on and on about this here, but one other thing that I found very interesting was they showed up a slide up in the front of the room showing how they apparently had compiled various lists of priorities that some of the counselors said contributed to the facilitators. And, not surprisingly, way up at the top of the list, you see sort of affordable housing, whatever that means, and various other, things about equity and economic opportunity and all of that. And I think it was a deputy city manager, Owen O'Riordan, who pointed out, he says, I hope everybody in this room realizes that a major portion of the city budget, it actually goes toward things like infrastructure. And he points to the chart on the wall and he says, and that's not even on your list up there. So in other words, there is a natural difference between the political people who want to make their goals and objectives to be the kinds of things that are, the people will immediately recognize and support, perhaps, and the city manager, who pretty much has to make sure the water system works, the roads function properly, the sewers, the storm drains work during a giant rainstorm, the streets are plowed, things like that, and these are really fundamentally different things. And whenever I think about this sort of dichotomy, it also makes me think about a topic that I'm sure I'll talk about shortly, which is matters having to do with the proposals to revise the city charter. There are these two competing proposals. One is to have a maintain a city manager form of government, a council manager form of government, versus a strong mayor, where the mayor becomes essentially takes on the role of a city manager, possibly with an assistant that does more management, perhaps, but. And I think when you actually look at it, how this is works in other cities, what you typically see is strong mayor systems tend to be sort of greatest hits type of government where everything is driven by populism and throwing people a bone, giving them nice things that they make them happy. But sometimes, like what happened in the city of Boston, where the water and sewer systems just are collapsing because it's really not properly managed. So, I think some of these questions that there was a sort of an echo in Owen O'Riordan's comment there of one of the fundamental differences between strong mayor systems and strong man and city manager and a properly managed system, like you see in a city manager kind of system. So anyway, I'll get back to that in a minute here, but I think I'm going to just do my little artificial break here right now. To break this up into two programs, even though we're doing it when recording here. So I'll be back momentarily here on Cambridge Inside Out.